Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our continued examination here at Loud and Clear of the issue of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy in the United States and U.S. policy, we are pleased to broadcast today an interview with two leading experts in the field of nuclear power. This interview took place on January 10th, 2018. In the studio is Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group from New Mexico, here lobbying in Washington, D.C. And we're also joined by Kevin Camps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. Welcome back, Greg and Kevin.
Thank you.
Let's talk about, you know, in our last segment, we were focusing on nuclear weapons. We were focusing on what's going on with between the United States and North Korea, how much money has been spent on nuclear weapons. Just this last week, however, Rick Perry, Secretary of Energy's panel review that was demanding that there be subsidies for the nuclear and coal industry, the panel of experts who were appointed by the Trump administration said no to the subsidy of nuclear power. Of course, we had Three Mile Island. The world knows about Chernobyl, the danger from Fukushima, all of the tragedies, catastrophic tragedies from nuclear energy and nuclear power plants. But where is it going, Kevin Camps? I mean, it seems also part of the consideration from the panel, maybe the primary one, wasn't about health and safety or the environment. It had more to do with the business side of nuclear power plants.
Right. So this was the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and it does have a majority of Trump directors now at this point. And despite all that, we just won a victory against the nuclear lobby just in the last couple of days, where FERC, as it's called, decided not to go forward with this Energy Secretary Perry proposed bailout scheme, which one of the FERC commissioners, the previous acting chairman, Chatterjee, who's a former aide to Mitch McConnell, so a huge coal fan for one thing, but also a nuclear power fan, was calling it a lifeboat, a lifeline, life support for these two dirty, dangerous, and expensive energy industries that are wreaking havoc upon the climate in the case of coal. And you mentioned some of the nuclear disasters that, you know, have done some damage to this planet too, with massive radioactivity releases. So Chatterjee was all for it. But despite that, this decision came down that they're not going to go forward. Now, the asterisk on this victory, and it is a victory because they wanted to get away with it, but there were, for example, Nuclear Information Resource Service alone generated 25,000 public comments against this idea. And then you add it to tens of thousands more from Public Citizen and Sierra Club, and we stopped it for now. The danger, though, because the nuclear lobby does not go away, the coal lobby does not go away, the danger is that this is going to get kicked to the regional transmission organizations like PJM, which stands for Pennsylvania, Jersey, and Mid-Atlantic. Maryland, yes, Mid-Atlantic, Maryland. It's Maryland. But PJM actually extends to Illinois. So it's the biggest electricity grid system in our country. And unfortunately, it is controlled by the electric utilities and the lobbies from these industries. And so they're going to try again in this even more obscure realm of the regional transmission organizations. So we're going to have to stay vigilant. And as has been the case for several years now, we've got to stop these subsidies from flowing, because what they're doing is they're, you know, continuing this climate catastrophe caused by coal and other fossil fuels. And in the nuclear realm, these old reactors in this country are disasters waiting to happen. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that's supposed to ensure safety at atomic reactors, is not only a captured agency, they are a rogue agency. So we have 100 operating reactors in this country, many of which are now not 40 years old. Some of them are approaching a half century. One of those, for example, is Oyster Creek, New Jersey, that fired up in December of 1969. That age-related degradation could lead to an American Fukushima.
And the Fukushima plant, is it similar to what we have here in the United States in terms of the model?
Fukushima Daiichi, the six reactors there were General Electric Mark I boiling water reactors. And as Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates has put it, many of the bad decisions that led to the Fukushima nuclear catastrophe were made in California by General Electric and its contractors. Things like removing tens of feet of elevation at the site to save money on pumping cooling water that then left the site wide open to that tsunami that caused three reactor meltdowns and nearly caused a high-level radioactive waste storage pool fire. And if that latter had happened, and it almost did, it did not happen because of sheer luck. The acting prime minister at the time, Khan, has said he had a secret contingency plan to evacuate up to 50 million people, 50 million people from northeastern Japan if that massive catastrophe had unfolded. And what has unfolded is a massive catastrophe, but dwarfed by what could have happened. And so we have nearly three dozen reactors of the exact same design or a very similar design, the Mark II, in the United States. I mentioned Oyster Creek, New Jersey, approaching a half century in age. It is a General Electric Mark I boiling water reactor. So the good news of these record-breaking numbers of reactor shutdowns in the United States in the last few years, places like Vermont Yankee, a very hard-won victory, that also was a GE Mark I reactor. By definition, it cannot now have a reactor core meltdown because the fuel has come out of the core, but it's been moved into the storage pool. And some more good news at Vermont Yankee is that that pool of high-level radioactive waste is being emptied at a relatively fast clip into safer, still not safe, dry cask storage on site. But we have pools at places like Oyster Creek and elsewhere that are full to the gills. And if they go up in flames, remember that figure, 50 million people would have to have been evacuated from northeast Japan.
Kevin, the UK government earlier this week announced that they had reached a point where 50% of the energy that's generated domestically, it comes from wind. The UK has been a heavily nuclear energy country for at least a half a century, maybe longer than half a century. Is there any reason why the United States can't get to something like that?
Not at all. I mean, you have groundbreaking work by the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Dr. Arjun Makajani. Back in 2007, he published a book called Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for the U.S. Energy Economy. And his thesis in 2007 was in the next 40 years or less, depending on political will, we could replace fossil fuels and nuclear completely from our economy for the same percentage of our gross domestic product as we currently spend on these dirty, dangerous, and expensive industries, and do it through renewable energy and through efficiency. The United States, given its geography, its large size, two coastlines, the sun of Arizona and Florida, we have more renewable resources than most countries in the world, including a place like Germany. Germany has made the decision to go renewable and efficient. They're going to turn off the last atomic reactor in 2022. That's a direct response to Fukushima. They're going to largely phase out fossil fuels by mid-century. We're talking 85% reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by getting rid of fossil fuels. And how are they doing this? They're doing it through maximized efficiency, which they've had for a long time, and they're doing it through renewable development. The thing is, Germany is far to the north of most of the United States.
Less and cloudy, something like 300 days a year.
Less solar potential, less coastlines for offshore wind, for sure. Less
or
land
mass. Tidal energy.
Yeah, less land mass for onshore wind. So if Germany can do it, the United States can do it. Germany is the fourth largest economy in the world. The United States is the first. The United States could make this happen in a relatively quick period of time if it chose to.
Whatever happened to T. Boone Pickens' plan to turn northern Texas into the largest wind farm in the world? Why did that never come to fruition?
Well, it kind of did, actually.
Did it?
West Texas is one of the largest growth areas for on-land wind power in the world, if you look at it on a regional basis. So I just happened to drive through West Texas several months ago, and the wind farms are large scale. They're often located on the tops of mesas, and it's very large scale. So, there was recent news coverage in the last few months of a very conservative town in Texas called Georgetown, I believe, and they are as red can be politically. And for economic reasons, they decided to mostly go with wind. They're going to save so much money as a community doing this, and they're tapping into that West Texas wind supply. And that was a point I wanted to make about Germany, too. The conservatives have ruled Germany for several years now under Merkel. And their point is, yeah, it saves the climate. That's pretty important when you live on this planet, to have a habitable planet to live on. But more important for the German Conservative Party is this is priming them to be the world leader in renewables, at least in the Western world, if not in the entire world. China's got some ideas about this, too. And so the United States is missing a huge business opportunity. We're going to get left in the dust by countries like Germany and China and others when it comes to wind power, solar power, efficiency.
Greg Miller, jump in if you would. Your focus is nuclear weapons, the Los Alamos Study Group, but this is integrated, and it's been integrated from the beginning, since the Manhattan Project. So go ahead.
Sure. This is a national security consideration of the first magnitude for the United States, and we are really missing the boat. It's painful. I was in a congressional hearing yesterday. It's very painful to hear Congress people talking about our abundant fossil fuel energy, which they would like to uncork and release on the world and the climate. But besides that, it isn't abundant. It's not so abundant. It might be abundant if you could sell oil at $150 a barrel, but at today's prices, it's finite, very finite. And to produce all that natural gas means fracking the whole country. I mean, you have to replace these wells every couple of years. They have about a 60% decline rate in the first year. So it's not a recipe that's sustainable economically, climatically, environmentally. From the business perspective, is completely dependent on unrealistically low interest rates. And there's a bankruptcy business model where executives get paid a lot and then they go bankrupt. So investors live, you know, that's how the system works.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting part of it, because the people in charge, they're going to get bailed out. They're going to have a golden parachute no matter what, even if the business model is not sustainable. And meanwhile, society has to live with the consequences.
And unfortunately, it maps very closely onto the Republican-Democrat divide in the country, so that you've got basically these factions which are driving the bus. And we hate to see partisanship in the climate debate. And we think that Democrats should really reach across the aisle and begin building bridges with Republicans, because I don't think we can go forward any other way. There's a link. Nuclear power stations are, of course, prime targets in war, are kind of pre-emplaced nuclear weapons, but they really contain a lot more radioactivity than a nuclear weapon. So when people think, oh, it's a big blast, a lot of radiation, but it's dwarfed by like 100 times by the radioactivity that is in storage at these sites already.
Oh, that's an important fact. I mean, the National Surveillance State justifies its existence in its all-encompassing, comprehensive, and I'd say unconstitutional data collection against of the American people and all people on the basis of keeping us safe, keeping the country safe. But that's an excellent point. I mean, the nuclear power plants themselves, with all of this stored radioactivity, they can't really be protected. And certainly the NSA mass data collection of our emails isn't doing a thing to protect that.
That's a really important point. I mentioned the pools at Fukushima Daiichi that almost went up in flames. And so in the United States, we have 100 of these pools at operating atomic reactors and at closed atomic reactors, where the pools are just kept full of irradiated nuclear fuel. And they're not even located inside containment structures. At least reactors are inside containments. We saw that containments.
How could that be?
It saved a lot of money for the industry.
So it's really, it's private profit driven corporations deciding to cut corners because they can reward themselves and their investors and attract more capital because their investment return is higher. So they're cutting corners and they're running the show.
And what the anti-nuclear and environmental movement of this country has been calling for 15 plus years is hardened on-site storage for that waste. Get it out of the pools that could go up in flames if attacked, or if there's an accident, if there's a natural disaster, get it out of the pools into dry cask storage on site, because there's nowhere else to go right now, as close as possible to the point of generation. and fortify it against attacks, safeguard it against accidents and natural disasters. And as you just said, none of these things are happening in order to save the industry money. And it's with the blessing of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and, unfortunately, with a derelict Congress whose job it is to oversee the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So we are, living on borrowed time.
Let's not forget the state regulatory bodies, which have the electricity rates primary in their mind, and as was said, making it possible for investors to profitably invest in these nuclear plants. And they are the ones that make the decisions to keep these things running under these conditions, which would really shock people if they understood.
Yeah, it would shock. It's shocking me. And I thought I knew something. Yeah. But because we treat things like this as a commodity, in other words, part of the marketplace, part of generating profit for an investor class, and those needs come first. That's the priority. But we're talking about not just a normal commodity. We're talking about commodities and the byproducts of the commodities that can wipe out human life and all living things for large parts of the country or large parts of the planet. I mean, here you have $7, $8, $9 trillion being spent for more nuclear weapons, but we're not building sort of storage facilities that are adequate to prevent these kind of catastrophic accidents. I mean, I think the American people truly just basically don't know.
Oh, that's it. They don't know. I think that this is when people listen to this conversation, they're going to be shocked by some of these details because people don't know.
You know, one phrase I'd like to get out on the table is this notion of a just transition. And this applies as much at Los Alamos National Laboratory as it does at the Palisades Atomic Reactor in Michigan, where I'm from. We do care about the nuclear workers. We would like to see these facilities transformed, in the case of Los Alamos, into peaceful purposes instead of atomic weaponry. And we'd like to see at Palisades a shutdown of this catastrophe waiting to happen and its replacement with renewables, for example. And just to give you an idea of how twisted things are right now, we've been talking about the bailout attempts to keep old reactors running. Unfortunately, we were not able to stop this in New York State under Governor Cuomo, who did good work on demanding the shutdown of the Indian Point nuclear power plant, which is very near New York City. And that's supposed to take place in 2020 and 2021. There are two reactors there. But the raw political deal that went into that, Cuomo himself led the charge to keep several upstate New York reactors on the Lake Ontario shoreline operating, supposedly to keep the employees in jobs. As we've been talking about, some of these facilities are nearly 50 years old. There are accidents waiting to happen. And in order to make that happen, $7.5 billion of ratepayer money was thrown at these atomic reactors over the course of the next decade or so. That is clean energy money that was supposed to go towards renewables and efficiency. That's New York. In Illinois, the same thing went down, just a little bit less money, $2.5 billion of ratepayer money to keep several old, dangerous atomic reactors operating, with, again, not only Republican support, like the governor, but even Democratic state legislators went for that one. They're trying to get away with this across the country. In Michigan at Palisades, just how twisted this all is, the company, Entergy, said it was going to shut down Palisades on January of 2019. I'm sorry, October of 2018, coming up. And they reversed their decision. And the reason was they had asked for kind of a severance package from the State Public Service Commission, as Greg mentioned, of close to $200 million, and they only got about $150 million. So they were shortchanged about $30 million. And as Tim Judson at Nuclear Information and Resource Service has put it, these companies, that's like pocket change. They could have found that amount of money in the couch cushions if they had looked for it. So because they didn't get all they wanted from the state, they've decided to just stick by their guns and keep running this perhaps most dangerous atomic reactor in the country on the shoreline of Lake Michigan, the drinking water supply for 15 million people. And we'll see how this goes.
Greg Mello, go ahead.
Sure. This just transition idea is very important because it's not only the moral thing to do, but it's also politically necessary. But in the case of the nuclear weapons laboratories, it's quite complex and difficult. About 25 years ago, we started the study group with the idea that we could convert the weapons labs to peaceful research. I worked on this for 3 years, 4 years. And then again, a few years later, we worked on Livermore again, and we discovered that the barriers were enormous, and all kinds of barriers. So the way that we would manage that these days is through retirements. There's very generous retirements that are offered, and incentives for people to work in civilian industry if they left these facilities. So you could manage a transition. You could get a lot more economic development out of it when they're Ann Markeson and her group has done a lot, did a lot on this in the 1990s. So when people leave these very specialized weapons facilities and go to work in the civilian economy, as happened in Seattle when Boeing had a big downturn, they went into the software industry and really boosted Seattle's economy more than Boeing had done.
This is an important piece to it, because the idea of jobs will also always be thrown in the face of those who are saying, for societal reasons, for environmental reasons, for common sense reasons, these facilities should be closed down. But somebody will say, but what about the workers? Same with the coal miners. Like, there should be an absolute pledge of conversion so that jobs that are lost because the industries need to be closed, that those workers are not the ones who are punished. Society and government at state legislatures or the federal government, it would be easily done to make a pledge to workers who are displaced that they have conversion, either very ample retirement plans or going into civilian industry. In the 1980s, the new president at that time of the International Association of Machinists, and the Machinists Union had a lot of jobs in the military and a lot of jobs inside of the nuclear industry. They argued that these things should be shut down, but that the machinist membership should be given jobs, that society should give them jobs. That's the easy and obvious and rational answer, rather than saying on Lake Ontario, we're going to keep a nuclear plant going that could annihilate the entire region so that the workers who are there don't lose their jobs. I mean, that's just obviously bizarre and absurd logic, except no one wants to make a commitment to conversion.
Well, and it really leads to all kinds of crazy stuff. So at Los Alamos National Laboratory, during the what's called American Recovery and Reinvestment Act period, after the big recession, but as a result of the 2008 downturn, there was an enhanced environmental cleanup program going on there, and it created jobs. You had to spend about $1 million to make a job, a single job. And then the waste was dug up from one place and then carted by truck to another mesa in Los Alamos and buried, and other waste was carted to Utah and buried. It was a net environmental gain, but it was nothing like the environmental gain that one could have had, and it was extremely inefficient in creating jobs. And there's a kind of a salary premium at a lot of these sites, which can't be matched. So at the weapons labs, people can't go from there to other jobs and make $100,000, $200,000 a year for being a mediocre physicist. It's very easy to become a millionaire as a nuclear weapons scientist. About 1 in 11 households in Los Alamos are cash millionaires, not counting the value of their homes. Very easy to accumulate that kind of money, and you can't duplicate it in the civilian economy.
Wow.
I wasn't thinking about the millionaires. I was thinking about other people in the job structures, because there obviously have to be not at the top, but there's a lot of workers, a lot of people in construction and engineering who are not making, you know, that kind of money. Anyway, let's talk in our last few minutes, because we're talking about nuclear accident possibilities, and we have 4 minutes, and it's just a matter of time, actually, before there's the next nuclear accident.
Sure.
It's just a matter of time.
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable. So this is not like some sort of rhetorical flourish. This is real. I want to talk about that, because I think it's, not to be alarmist, but it's alarming, and I think we should talk about it. And also the same goes for nuclear weapons accidents, because there's been a couple times, maybe more than a few times, where the society or our planet was almost, or big parts of it, almost annihilated because of nuclear weapons accidents.
And oftentimes those accidents are classified. And so either the information never gets out or it gets out 20 or 30 years after the fact.
So let's break this last 3.5 minutes up in two parts. Let's deal first with the nuclear weapons, a nuclear power plant and the nuclear energy industry. What are the big dangers there? Let's do 1.5 minutes and then go, Greg Mello, to talk about nuclear weapons accidents.
Well, we have 100 operating atomic reactors in the United States. There's 20 or about that in Canada. And there are so many pathways to catastrophe at these facilities. And for that reason alone, the age-related degradation is a growing factor. We are in uncharted waters with these reactors, with a rogue nuclear regulatory commission that is complicit with risk-taking and the taking of shortcuts to boost profits. So we're really living on borrowed time. As I mentioned, getting the waste out of the pools, even at the shutdown reactors where it's still stored, is a huge upgrade in safety that needs to be done in a prompt, careful way. As is happening at the ruined Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, they are very carefully getting the irradiated nuclear fuel out of these destroyed reactors in the pools where it still presents a danger. So one last thing I'd like to say quickly is that nuclear power is not atoms for peace. That is a deception. And so any claim of transition from nuclear weapons into nuclear power needs to be taken with a very large grain of salt, because nuclear power can lead to nuclear weapons and is itself a huge catastrophic risk.
Excellent points. That's Kevin Kemps. He's the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. Greg Mello, last word with you. Nuclear weapons accidents, it's real. Also real.
It's very real. And there are overt accidents, and then there are structural chronic precursors to accidents which we can't understand except in historical retrospect. So in the Cuban Missile Crisis, there were a lot more things that could have gone wrong than even the most informed participants at the time knew about, because knowledge wasn't perfect. We've got postures which people make, and we have the soft and hard power of an empire at stake in these confrontations. And steps can be taken which only in hindsight could be irreversible, seen as irreversible. So you might have – so much is made of Trump's impetuousness, which is, I think, important and accurate. But there's also the inexorable stuff that goes on, the – coup d'etat in Ukraine, fomented under Hillary Clinton by Victoria Nuland. That is something which becomes the foundation for conflict. It's the Russiagate narrative, which is being pushed here in this city. Stephen F. Cohen rightly remarks that this is one of the most dangerous things that's happened, because it sets the stage for confrontation and makes every crisis worse. So We've had a lot of nuclear weapons accidents, but I wouldn't focus on those technical managerial accidents. I would focus on the ones which come from policy and which come quite from miscalculation of intent and folly.
And there's been so many miscalculations. We're going to wrap it up, but so many miscalculations. When you think about Iraq, when you think about Libya, when you think about that axis of evil speech and North Korea being added on, so many, you know, really powerful miscalculations. Anyway, we're completely out of time. We've been joined in our Washington, D.C. studio by Greg Mello. He's the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group in New Mexico. And we've been joined by Kevin Kemps. He is the radioactive waste watchdog at the advocacy organization Beyond Nuclear. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.